Today is 8 March 1984. My name is Jack Spey, 850 Tarpon Drive, Fort Walton Beach, Florida. Bruce, this slide presentation and tape is intended to provide an overview of the ranch hand operation, in which 18 million gallons approximately of herbicides were dispensed by a grand total of about 1,280 men, or about 15,000 gallons per man. This includes supply personnel, admin personnel, as well as air crew and flight crew throughout the entire 9-year history of the unit from 1962 until 1971. I'll attempt on each of the slides to try to point out those items which, from my vantage point, not having talked with you and your group any more than I have, that I think could be significant and might aid you as you hear testimony from plaintiffs in trying to, you know, find weaknesses in their testimony or whatever. Obviously, anything that, you know, any questions that come out of this, I'll, you know, be more than happy to try to clarify, or the same questions obviously can be put to some of the other fellows with whom you're in contact. Slide one. Slide one was taken in 1962. That's a picture of me. That's a picture of our ratty building, and I think you can see by the sign that pretty well says the whole business. One thing to note is the flying garb at the time. The standard Air Force flight suit, standard flying boots. In this case, I'm wearing a flak jacket, and you can't see what we call diapers, flak pants that are fitted over the flight suit. However, it's significant, I think, to note from a legal standpoint that there's no special protective clothing or anything else being worn. Slide two is a picture of patches, probably the most famous, C-123, in the defoliation mission. Official maintenance records indicate that this airplane received in excess of 600 bullet holes through her during her career there, both as a defoliation airplane and later on. She was dedicated to the mosquito control business because the Air Force agreed that she should someday, hopefully, if she survived her career in Southeast Asia and then later survived her career in the Air Reserve here in this country, that she would end up at the Air Force Museum at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which she finally did get there, although she's currently in camouflage as a result of being painted after she returned to the CONUS. It's interesting to note from Buckingham's book that our unit took over 7,000 hits from enemy ground fire. This again equates to over, or right at about a 10 hits, if you will, I'm sorry, 7 hits, if you will, or 7 bullets for each individual that ever served in the unit. I think these figures are indicative of the fact that tend to negate the argument, if you will, that our mission was flown over friendlies. I certainly hope those 7,000 rounds didn't come from friendlies, but actually, in fact, we were primarily operating in, particularly in the large area defoliation, away from lines of communication. In that area, controlled by the enemy, both from a defoliation standpoint as well as a crop destruction standpoint. The figures that I quote are out of William Buchanan's book, Operation Ranch Hand, which I think you and your group are quite familiar with. But this is one of the six original airplanes that deployed to Southeast Asia during the original deployment. This is a picture, slide number three. I'll try to throw the cue on. Slide number three shows a briefing in operation where you have the large scale map, the general overlay directly behind the briefing officer, and then you have the more detailed maps on the left showing a detailed blow up of the particular target area and then what appears to be weather synoptic charts. This photograph is the 1967-68 time frame. And cue for a slide change. The slide number four you might characterize as a 1967-68 well-dressed ranch hand air crew. As you can see, he's wearing basic fatigue uniform, flak jacket over top of that uniform, sleeves rolled up, no protective clothing. He is wearing a helmet, which provided ballistic protection for the upper neck and head, and also allowed us to utilize visors, clear visors, so that we didn't experience shrapnel injuries to the eyes while flying. We had both a sun visor and a clear visor, in later years a double visor, where we put a clear down for early morning low light level spraying, and of course if it was bright sunlight, well then we could pop the clear up and during the en route times back and forth to target or coming back from target generally, and later on in the morning we'd have a sun shield. Next slide. This next slide is a view of a flight engineer in his t-shirt. His fatigue jacket has been removed, or his fatigue shirt has been removed because of temperature. He is, however, wearing his flak jacket. He's holding his helmet, and we are facing the cockpit crew entrance ladder to the flight deck to the right-hand side of the frame. Next slide. This is a view of the spray tank, and in the foreground the rectangular piece, although it's a little bit difficult to show much detail, is the spray console, the throttle controls for the motor, the pressure gauge and so forth, and the associated plumbing leading from the tank motor to the tail boom and wing booms, and the L-shaped, that's the L-shaped tube, which is the exhaust pipe for the gasoline-driven engine. This is the flight deck. We're looking from the back of the airplane, looking forward. This tank was about 10 feet long, excuse me, held 1,000 gallons and pretty much took up the entire main portion of the cargo compartment of the C-123. Next slide. This slide is a shot of the cockpit looking through the keyhole shaped opening through the forward bulkhead, the 120 bulkhead. We're looking straight out the windshield, although we're looking at from below eye level, or below windshield level. just to note again, the air crew, in this case, the pilot and the co-pilot, are flying with their arms bare. Their shirts are removed, their t-shirts only, because of comfort and high temperatures. And they are wearing their helmets. And this was the basic garb, either the old standard Air Force flight suit or, and later on, the jungle type fatigues, with the shirts removed in an effort to try to stay comfortable, you know, because of the generally warm temperatures, in as much as the airplane was not air conditioned. Again, this shot shows the co-pilot or the instructor pilot in the right-hand seat. In this case, it was probably a survey mission. He was not having his helmet on, and he simply chose to, because of temperature and comfort and whatnot, he was wearing his fatigues, but again, his, you know, the sleeves are rolled up. And the point being that we didn't wear any protective clothing. There was no need to wear protective clothing, in as much as the chemical was believed then and as is now to be, you know, harmless to people. Next slide. This is a picture of the flight line, 1967 time frame. It's interesting to note in this particular picture that all of the aircraft have been painted camouflage, with the bottom of the airplanes painted kind of an off-white. This was generally their color scheme after 1966-67. You'll notice that the insignia on the aircraft in the mid-ground is the VNAV insignia, or the Vietnamese Air Force insignia, which was identical to our insignia as far as layout is concerned. The colors were different. These airplanes here have VNAV markings, Vietnamese Air Force markings. There's a little bracket there that we could slide in the appropriate VNAV marking or USAF marking, depending on the nature of the mission. If it was a crop destruction mission, if we remember to do it, generally we put the VNAV markings in that insert. The other thing to note is the maintenance personnel in the foreground, dressed typically as any other maintenance personnel working, you know, with any other type of C-123 that wasn't operating or wasn't in the, you know, in the herbicide business. Next slide. These are the Herbie tanks, as they were generally referred to. In order to effect more rapid turnaround, if the flight was a turnaround mission, in other words, we'd spray, come back in, rejuice, and go out again. As the unit expanded and got larger, they started using condemned fuel trailers, and that's what we see here. The Vietnamese, with American supervision, were responsible to take the 55-gallon drums and pump the 55-gallon drums into these tanks, and it simply allowed us, it made stockpiling of the material easier and allowed a quicker turnaround using the large trailer tanks originally used as fuel tanks. Next slide. This shot here shows the 123s in maintenance. You can see the cowlings are open, the flaps are down, the herbicide tanks, the three yellow tanks between the two aircraft in the foreground, The aircraft are undergoing routine maintenance in the foreground, and in the background, of course, the ready line being serviced and whatnot in preparation for a spray sorting. The other interesting thing to note is the red stripe, or the International Dayglow stripe, painted longitudinally from wingtip to wingtip. Because the airplanes were later camouflaged, it became difficult for forward air control or observer aircraft above, or fighter aircraft assisting in our mission from above, and in some cases ourselves, to maintain visual contact with each other. And for this reason, the red stripe was painted, the international gold stripe was painted from wingtip to wingtip to aid in visibility between aircraft. Next slide. In this slide, you'll see the aircraft parked in a ready position. They're serviced and having returned, and you can see the crew doors are open. The maintenance personnel utilizing bicycles and so forth to get back and forth across the ramp. This picture was taken at Benoit, and the time frame would be about 1968. Next slide. The next series of pictures shows will give one a general idea of the type of formation that was employed on a general set of targets. Bruce mentioned one individual talking about the airplane spraying in a V formation. When most of us think of formation flying, we tend to think of a Blue Angel or a Thunderbird type demonstration position, generally referred to as a fingertip. If you take your three middle fingers and hold them up and tuck away your little finger and your thumb, you have three fingers, the lead aircraft, the uppermost, and the two wingmen on either side. This is a normal formation for aircraft en route, or in demonstration for that matter, when no tactical or no maneuvering or a small amount of maneuvering is involved, or in the case of the Thunderbirds or the Blue Angels, a very high degree of proficiency is involved. While energetic maneuvers are being carried out, when the ranch hand pilots, and as a group, was noted for good formation flying, as far as the C-123 is concerned, you realize that we were talking about a cargo type airplane, relatively ugly looking thing. But when we flew formation, particularly coming home to home plate, why, we came down the center line of the runway at altitude in a close formation, as you see in this first slide, where the wingman, in this case, would be number two, was tucked in fairly close with just barely wingtip clearance between the two aircraft. This was a useful en route formation, but was tiring. It was not the formation that we sprayed from, for a number of reasons, and I'll point those out as we go into the next series of slides. Someone not associated with the operation might think that might have the perception that when we were going to go off and spray, that they might expect to see us spraying in what we refer to as a fingertip formation. There is a number of reasons why this would be dangerous for the airplanes involved, and from a maneuvering standpoint would be practically impossible, as I'll try to point out as we go on through this next series. Next slide. Again, if you'll notice from this slide and the other slide, the previous slide, the aircraft are at altitude. We are either going from our home base to the general spray area, flying at a close formation. In this case, the aircraft are in a left echelon. Lead is just barely visible. We can just see his tail. Number two is on his left wing, and number three, that contained the photographer, is on the left wing of number two. This formation is in a left echelon. The basic spray formation was done from an echelon with the lead aircraft hitting the start coordinates and the wingmen being staggered either left or right of him. In this case, if we were at spray altitude, we're obviously echelon to the left. So that the total swath width is then a combination of whatever number of aircraft are in the formation. And in some cases, it was, you know, up to 7 or 8 or 12 airplanes in a formation. It's important to note, however, that the longitudinal spacing, that is, the distance between the two airplanes, as you're going to see in the next series of slides, is greatly elongated. In other words, we're not tucked in close, if you will, as you see in this en route picture. We're presently at about 4,000 feet. Of course, we're out all over the South China Sea also, but had we been over land, as you saw in the previous slide, we'd generally be free of small arms fire, light machine gun fire, at that altitude. And this was the altitudes that are above that we used going en route to target or coming home from a target. In other words, there was no sense in trolling and being down at a vulnerable altitude if you didn't have any reason to be there. But keep in mind that when we sprayed from an echelon, not a V, and that the echelon or the longitudinal spacing was stretched way out. Not as you see here. This is kind of a going home and let's get a little close wing formation so we look good when we fly over the field and pitch out and land. Next slide. Prior to entering a target area, the echelon, if we were just flying loose, we went into a position that was referred to as piggyback. Now this slide shows three C-123s ahead of the aircraft from which the picture is taken. And we are looking down. We are flying, if you will, a high trail position on each other. The reason for this is that now aircraft in front of you can maneuver at whatever rate necessary to obtain alignment onto a target, and the aircraft behind have no difficulty in following that airplane. We went piggyback generally after the lead aircraft was able to see the IP for the target or the target boundaries. And in this case, if you look carefully, you can see the burn across the foliage up in front of the aircraft. And it appears as though the lead aircraft is going to line up on the right-hand edge of the burn that's slightly to the right of the center of this frame. The echelon, or the other aircraft, the wingman, will then assume a right echelon and slide out laterally to the right, maintaining a longitudinal distance between aircraft of somewhere between 200 to 400 feet. That distance not being particularly critical, it's just whatever you are comfortable with. This position was assumed for a high-speed descent. In other words, a rapid descent from a safe in-route altitude to the target boundaries, because it allowed complete flexibility on the part of the men behind you or the aircraft behind you to maneuver and adjust airspeed so that they didn't overrun somebody in front of them. Next slide. Here we have a picture of a straight defoliation, large area target, and you'll notice the lateral spacing between the aircraft is relatively wide because each of the airplanes had a swath width of about, you know, effectively about 260 feet. You'll notice also that the longitudinal spacing, we are number three, or as you, the aircraft that you're now viewing from is the third aircraft in the formation, and you'll notice that the longitudinal spacing is quite large. The reason for this was that, and this spacing varied depending on the opposition that we expected in the target area, but it was never in tucked in close like you saw in a dress formation or a coming home formation. The reason being is that if the aircraft in front of you experienced engine problems, which results in directional control problems, it might be necessary, or he might end up breaking across in front of you. If you can recall back to a close wingtip formation and that man broke rapidly in front of you due to an engine out on your side, it would be very difficult to break away from him and avoid a mid-air collision. And for this reason, the longitudinal spacing was important, where you didn't want to be up so close to him. Now, the basic rule of thumb is, you asked yourself the question, if he breaks hard into me for whatever reason, can I go up and over him and avoid him and allow him to break out across the formation, across the echelon, and take care of his mechanical problem? If the answer to that question was no, then you were too close and you simply backed off. So that it was on target as we are now, it was a relatively loose formation. And the basic criteria was, if he broke hard in front of me, can I go up and over him, fill in for him while he breaks out and takes care of whatever problem it is, and continue and avoid a midair? Next slide. In this picture here, we're number four, and while it's a little bit out of focus, this is a DoD slide and it's gone through a number of reproductions, but it's significant in one way. We're number four with three aircraft in front of us, and not actually having been in this particular formation, I would say that we, number four, are getting up a little close. If the man right in front of us here were to break to the right due to engine outage or mechanical problems or ground fire tore up an engine or whatever, we as number four would have to move pretty quick to go up and over and allow him to break away across in front of us. It's difficult for him to go left because there's higher terrain to the left. Generally speaking, lead took the high side and the wingmen stacked down to the low side. That way, they had a way out if they had to break out. And the idea being was that the man in front of you had the right of way. If he had difficulty, it was the responsibility of the man behind to avoid a mid-air collision. Also noted, you can note from this slide, the red stripe painted longitudinally across the wing. The other thing to note is that each individual airplane is at a slightly different altitude. You can see that it's a variable terrain, and each airplane was following or terrain flying that terrain which was directly underneath them. So that the idea being is the object was to try to maintain a contour as closely as possible and follow that contour and on the terrain that existed underneath your particular airplane. At the same time trying to maintain the lateral spacing between aircraft, you know, to ensure coverage of the entire area. Next slide. This particular slide probably shows nothing more than a mass gaggle. I'm not sure how many airplanes are in a right echelon in this case, but I can count about five. And we're number six. And I would say that this particular shot, everyone is particularly five and four and five, or maybe closed in a little bit in too far. I'd hate to have number four break across number five if you ran into a breakout situation. But some of the formations for large area defoliation, you know, ran a large number of airplanes. Next slide. In this shot, it looks like number three in a left echelon, and again noting the longitudinal spacing. Excuse me. I think you're able to detect the discoloration that exists out in front of the lead airplane. This is a large area defoliation mission where we're filling in the burn, or filling in between burns, or extending the burn from the right to the left. In other words, we're working the area from right to left. The smoke that you see coming up ahead of the C-123s are as a result of a CBU strike or a cluster bomb strike. This particular mission was in an area where ground fire was either anticipated or had been received before in those particular areas, and the CBU strike was put down ahead of the aircraft, and we attempted to follow as quickly as we could behind that CBU strike to get down, get it sprayed, and get on through while their ears were still ringing and this sort of thing. Again, to be noted, the fact that we weren't spraying in friendly areas in this particular case or in the majority of the cases. Obviously, otherwise we wouldn't have needed, fighter support in advance of our own mission. Next slide. Again, here you'll notice a large flat area being sprayed. The formation again is in a right echelon, and again to note that it's not a V formation, and the distance is not certainly what we normally think of in terms of aircraft formation flying, to where we're not tucked in close. Again, we're spread out longitudinally to ensure breakout clearance. Note that these airplanes are K aircraft or jet assisted or jet modified airplanes. Again, right echelon, flat terrain. Next slide. You You'll notice in this particular picture the tail boom, the spray coming from the tail boom, and you also notice the troop doors, or the troop door, that white line vertically about halfway along the fuselage is open, and this was to allow the flight engineer to throw out smoke grenades in the event that we were hit by ground fire. Directly below the airplane is the smoke, probably caused by an ordnance strike of some sort. You'll notice that we are a little lower than the lead aircraft in as much as he's sitting above the horizon. Probably as a result of just a little bit of altitude deviation, 15, 20 foot deviation on the part of the second aircraft. This is another shot in the same sequence that you saw a little bit before, again showing the CBU strike down the right hand edge of the target. Notice that the longitudinal spacing is quite long here, with three or 400 feet longitudinally between aircraft. And you can see the burn right underneath the windshield wiper in the foreground of our aircraft. This is the burn line that lead is following. It's probably a two months between the time the right hand portion was sprayed until we then coming back to follow this particular burn. Judging from the formation that we're in, a right echelon, you're only able to see lead through the center support structure of that divided the two front windows. Well, actually, I guess we're number three, or at least number three. There's two airplanes out there. But it looks like we're approaching the end of a target, which is the river, the edge of the river coming up in the foreground, with the CBU strike having been put down across the edge of the river, perpendicular to the aircraft, and the aircraft are fixing to brake and climb as rapidly as possible. Next slide. This is just a representative shot of the C-123, vintage of about 1966. The tail boom has been installed. The Vietnamese markings are on the fuselage. It doesn't appear to be a K model. It's a B model C-123. Next slide. This is one of the earlier shots taken from a non-spraying airplane, showing the troop door open. This is wing boom only, no tail boom. This would be about 1963, 64, somewhere in that time frame. The tail number of the airplane is 370. This is one of the original 6C-123s that deployed. And of course the non-camouflage paint job, which generally existed up until about the 1965-66 time frame. Next slide. Here is a shot again in a right echelon. I believe this sequence here was taken in the Ashaw Valley in I Corps, Vietnam, west of Da Nang. In this case, lead is lined up on the CBU strike that's been put down, and the echelon again is a right echelon. You'll notice that the spacing is a little closer, and the idea here was to close it up a little bit so that everybody got through together, if you will, or as closely together, and taking advantage of the airstrike that you can see the smoke coming from. Next slide. This is a picture here of some large area work that was done, or some large area defoliation work that was done alongside a main road, as you can see on the left-hand side there, where the trees and shrub had been cut down by hand. And it shows the one airplane breaking off. This is looking out the troop, or out the cargo loading door and ramp, right straight out the back of the airplane, looking down on the aircraft just coming off the spray run. Next slide. This last sequence of slides shows some of the effect in a general way of the herbicide mission. We're looking at Rungsat Special Zone south-southwest of Saigon. I'm sorry, south-southeast of Saigon, or what was often referred to as the Saigon River. You notice that the burn, or that area which has turned brown, often referred to as the burn, is quite dramatic on the right-hand side. And Bruce, if you'll recall, when you were down and we talked about this, what you're seeing on the right-hand side is that upwind edge. The wind in this case, during application, was blowing from the right to the left, so that all the small particles generated by turbulence around the nozzles and so forth were drifted to the left, or from right to left, so that only the more dense particles reached the ground, affecting the foliage. And as a result, the upwind line, or the upwind edge of the burn, is quite dramatic, or quite contrast, as opposed to the downwind is less delineated by contrast, because the smaller particles dropped at varying rates depending on their size and mass, and it's more feathered. But here you see a case of a very pronounced burn line, or upwind line, so that any out-of-target drift in this particular case, given the wind conditions, had they been blowing the same direction through the entire work period of this area, which was substantial, there's probably 20 sorties in this, 20 aircraft spray widths in this picture right here, would have been blowing from right to left, which would be basically right, correct. The wind's coming out of the southeast, and we're looking northeast, so that the prevailing wind would be from right to left. But this is an example of your pronounced upwind burn, where your downwind burn is going to be much more feathered and just gradually dissipates. Next slide. Here again you have an example in the same general area of the pronounced upwind burn, where you have the untreated foliage in the upper center portion of the picture, and the treated portion, the lower left and lower right hand portion of the picture. Next slide. This particular slide I included to give you an idea of some of the difficulty involved in flying adjacent to a previous burn. You'll notice that it was the area covered from the corner of the river in the foreground, looking up the slide, or in the 12 o'clock position of the slide, was quite uniform until we came to an area where they tried to fill, and it was difficult, evidently, for Lead to observe the edge of the burn. He came in and sprayed missed that one little swath, which looks like it might be about one airplane's width. And some of the other folks look like they may have had partial tanks, so that they ran out before they reached the, you know, the longitudinal boundaries working perpendicular to the way this slide is shot. We're about ready to run out of tape, so if you can go ahead and reverse the tape, and we'll change to the next slide.